That sort of discernment in certain ways is like being able to distinguish the foreground from the background, or objects from the background, to be able to kind of assess or measure thought or idea in relation to a background condition of previous thoughts or somebody else's opinion or something. So discernment and stillness is another strange topic, or increasing stillness with awareness, like mindfulness, leading to discernment. I think there's a connection there. But yeah, people talk about psychedelics, right? Psychedelic drugs as mind expanding, right? Or expanding consciousness. So expanding perception is like the basis of expanding consciousness. And perception being distinct from conception, perception just being the ability to perceive, obviously, right? What's another word for that? To be sensitive to contact with phenomena. So increasing sensitivity to contact with phenomena, increasing awareness that there is a lot of phenomena, you know, that there's more stuff around, right? Like the more we see, the more we realize there is yet to be seen. So I would say expanding perception is an expansion of sensitivity, realizing how much more phenomena is present, or is in play, or can be understood. Understanding how vast that systems and interrelations between systems, you know, a system like a self, like a person, or a society, or a group, or a karmic stream, or a planetary soul group, or even the present time on planet Earth, right? These could be called systems or fields of phenomena, beings and patterns and intentions and all sorts of things. Definitely, expanding awareness is based in expanding perception. And that, you know, like the phrase, right? The doors of perception becoming cleansed. It's you can say that it's simply the doors of perception being cleansed, and as they're cleaner, we see more, or there's increasing perception based on more, you know, less obstructed perception. We're seeing more because we're less obstructed, less blocked. And I just read something very interesting today, or not today, a few days ago. I was thinking about dukkha, the first noble law of Gautama, the truth of suffering or dissatisfactoriness or stress. And realized that, first of all, for me, there that some portion of background dukkha, right? There's the dukkha of being punched. Oh, and I was watching Mike Tyson's 20 best knockouts. Boy, oh boy. I wouldn't want to be ahead of one of those fellows in the ring with him. But the word dukkha came from earlier Sanskrit, where there are two different ways, you know, or even the scholars argue what the etymological root of the word dukkha is. But it's basically something like dukkha, or dusta, something strange like that. And the first part, du, is opposed to su, like dukkha sukha. And so D, you know, like Hilarion talks about the letter D, right? As poorly indicating in a person's name. Du means bad or inferior or inappropriate or wrong or misdone, poorly done or something. While su means good or happy. So dukkha sukha. But the ka was originally something like the axle hole in a chariot, for the Aryans, right? 4,000 years ago. And Dukkha was a bad axle hole. Man, I'm having a bad axle hole today. You're just a bad axle hole. Which really means a bumpy ride or a miss an obstructed axle hole for the wheels axle in the chariot of the ancient Aryans. And so a bad hole is a bad gives a bad ride. So it's a bad hole. It really means obstruction. The what should be empty space is obstructed. And in many ways, dukkha or basic dissatisfaction is obstructing empty space. Is an obstruction in spaciousness in mind by thought, by desire. An obstruction in mind of natural spaciousness by thought or desire or aversion, right? Grasping, aversion, ignorance by the three poisons. Some I want, I hate, I want, or I want to remove, or I don't know. The three poisons or desire or aversion, grasping, ignorance, all the patterns of mind, and in fact, you can even say thought itself acts as as an obstruction in mind, obscuring the natural spaciousness and thus creating a bad hole, a bad ride from an obstructed hole, from an obstructed mind, from spaciousness of being obstructed by mind, by thought. And it struck me that the real one of the deep roots of dukkha is the mind that just says, this is not enough. I don't like this. Or there must be something else. Or what about then? The now is okay, but what about then? Or what about yesterday? And it's a mind that is basically dissatisfied with what is, or its basic dissatisfaction. It's the thought, there must be something wrong here. And that goes all the way back to one of the, 12 nidanas and dependent origination, the 12 links in the chain of arising, birth, and death. Paticca-samuppada, very famous dependent origination theory teaching in Buddhism, but particularly the qualities I think of craving and clinging, tanha and upadana. Some kind of craving, some sense that I'm hungering, and then I cling to something, upadana. And it's some kind of sense that there's something wrong here. And I think our mind is always, or most always there, very commonly there. There must be something wrong. There must be something more. It couldn't be only this. There's this restlessness, and that is like an obstruction in space in mind, like a bad hole that gives a bad ride. So that's what I was thinking recently. And so you can say that expansion of perception, or spiritual evolution as expansion of perception, or purification of perception, cleansing the doors of perception, same, really, is de-obstructifying, de-obstructing, is removing obstructions in mind to the capacity, the ability to simply enjoy being, to enjoy spacious being, to enjoy or be present. And nothing else is sought, seeking nothing else. Here, okay, that's it. I mean, that's a strange way to live, but it's non-obstructive. Any comments on that? Yeah, you mean sort of like Ra's teaching, the moment contains love, or all is complete and whole and perfect, or sacred as is. So that's similar to what I'm saying, which is not obstructing the natural spaciousness of mind. Tibetan Buddhists talk about that a lot. I mean, Tibetan Buddhism has a lot of problems, but some of their reformulation of early Buddhist teaching is excellent, and their understanding that the natural state of mind is awakening, which really means spaciousness. So, but for you in that case, it would be when you perceive that perfectionism arises, when you perceive that you have dissatisfaction and feeling that there's something wrong, acknowledge, recognize that that's arising. And then you could look at, is that really true? Is there really a problem here? Or is it just, my habit to be dissatisfied with what is and imagine there must be something better yet to be fashioned? But in some cases, it's a hard call because let's say you're talking with somebody and they're weird or they're obstructive in their mind. I mean, somebody who misunderstands us, somebody who imposes or projects onto us their misunderstanding of us, and they think that's who we are. Is that perfect? And what do you do? Just say, okay, sure, yeah. While they persist with a clear wrong view of us or something, wrong view of something, right?
Right.
But the deep, yes, well, shit can roll off us when we're in that cap when we have that capability. How do we establish that capability like the lotus, growing in the mud, from which the water simply falls off or peels off and doesn't get absorbed into the substance of the flower. How to get that way? How to become like that? Well, the idea being, names, sticks and stones can hurt, sticks and stones break my bones, but names can never hurt me when I know my true name. When I know my name. Somewhere, somebody told me, or I read, and maybe I've said it before, and I don't know where it came from. I just wrote it in my diary. I don't even know where the source. The quote is something like, "They love you because you know who you are." And it's very deep, I think. They love you because you know who you are. You know who you are means you know your true name. You know your true name means you know your real identity. You know your identity. What is your identity? Well, it's going to be something beyond the philosophy that we use to describe identity. I am the one infinite creator. I am one. I am Atman. I am the I am. I am free, whatever. Gautama said that there's no permanent self. That there was some a lot of typical kind of fourfold negation when Gautama was talking about self. It's something like the self is not in the mind and with a form, nor is it outside the mind with a form, nor is it formless in the mind, nor is it formless outside the mind, meaning it's not limited by the body. The view that self is not associated with the body and formless is one of the four wrong views of self. But we commonly may think, self is this sort of formless, multi-dimensional presence. At least that's what I think. Self is a formless, multi-dimensional presence with sentience and energy fields. I think that's a pretty sophisticated understanding. But that's probably wrong view too. And so, what is your true name? What is your name? Who are you? So Ramana Maharshi, right, asking that as a kind of leading edge koan or meditative question, who are you? What is your true name? Well, the name given at birth is not it. So now we go by via negativa, the path of negatives or negation. It isn't the body. It isn't your human personality of a single lifetime. It isn't what arises in the mind, although that's all a portion or an aspect of the greater self or being or whatever we are. In the end, you really can't name yourself, but you can know yourself. You can know yourself, but you can't really name yourself. You don't know what we are nameless, I think. Now, this is very, right on the edge of psychosis, but some people will spin out and then fools will criticize. But essentially, self is nameless, like the Godhead is nameless. Meaning all names are partial and incomplete, as a representation of all we are. But even in even but from Gautama's perspective, even to say the view that self is separate from mind, body, and formless is also considered mistaken. It's one of the four wrong views. So what's your name? Well, again, I think one can know it without, one can know it as nameless. That requires gnosis. By gnosis, one knows it as nameless, and then may use name freely, or, you know, somehow, as a convention, as a conventional, as a upaya, skillful means. One uses name because we have to talk, right? If we didn't talk, there would be, you know, we'd just be sitting here in silence and people would be thinking. So instead of, you know, unguided thinking, we have group talking. But what is your name? So, I mean, that's the point. If you know, you can give yourself a name or discover a name, but actually it's only a temporary appellation, a temporary tag. Essentially, identity is nameless, seems, as far as I know. And yet one can know that. And that's, you know, that's awakening. That those are the stages of awakening. Know thyself. And then it just changes how we feel when other people misname us or misunderstand us. What do you think? Yeah, I mean, Raft is basically view and practice. And so everything we're talking about now is rectification of view. You know, there was a chapter in one of the Gnostic tractates called The Rectification of Name, I believe. Valentinus or one of those guys. Those guys, you know, so 2,000 years ago, they're already way up here in this upper atmosphere talking about the philosophy of identity or savior and identity and name. But, yeah, it's the top-down approach, right? To get our spiritual view clear, to purify spiritual view, so as to purify some of the roots of emotion, the roots of tendency. So anyway, yeah, and the word yogi or yoga. Comes from some ancient Sanskrit, yuk. When you're enunciating ancient Sanskrit or Proto-Indo-European (PIE), you have to imagine yourself very much like Central Asian steppe man, 4000 BC. So you say yuk. And that means yoke, like, you know, like put the yoke on your oxen, please. And so it means to yoke, yoke, or to harness, to harness force. And so the yogi or yogini, for a female it's called yogini, yogi, yogini. The yoga practitioner harnesses the force of prana. And so it is very much a white magical path, actually. It's the original white magic. And it's not, and then there are different approaches, right? So different yogas, but some are more controlling, like pranayama or kriya yoga, than, you know, raja yoga, meditating on your breath without control, which is very Buddhist. So, yes, you are what you do, and there's another interesting thing, which is that in the Buddhist understanding of cosmology, the word loka, like kama loka, rupa loka, arupa loka, the three worlds, tri loka in Buddhism, the word loka, like we talked about this before a long time ago, loka means a realm or the people of a realm. And so a dimensionality is in many ways defined by the level of consciousness of the beings there. So the animal realm is the realm, the place of animals. The human realm, or Kamaloka, is the place of humans with desire, kama. And so the people define the place. You know, home is where the heart is. So you can say the realm is of the consciousness of the beings there. And so 3D is, you know, the lower triad, the lower zone is 3D because it includes first, second, third. And that's just an interesting way of putting it. So that, you know, the ancient Hindus, Buddhists, sages, I mean, there's not that many of them, okay? It's not like everybody 4,000 years ago was a radiant sage in India, but there were some, and they really were much more advanced than most spiritual teachers today. So thanks for good questions and a very interesting discussion, and see you next time.